This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In spite of his terminal brain cancer, Senator Edward Kennedy managed to give a brief speech last night at the Democratic National Convention. Here's an excerpt.
For me, this is a season of hope. New hope for a justice and fair prosperity for the many, and not just for the few. New hope. And this is the cause of my life. New hope. That we will break the old gridlock and guarantee that every American, north, south, east, west, young, old, will have decent, quality health care as a fundamental right and not a privilege.
Both the Obama and the McCain campaigns have proposals for reforming health care. We're going to take an in-depth look at those proposals with Jonathan Oberlander. This month, he wrote an article in the New England Journal of Medicine called The Partisan Divide, comparing the two plans. He says the plans reveal some of the candidates' assumptions about the virtues and vices of markets and government. Oberlander is an associate professor of social policy and health policy management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and he's a visiting scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation. He's talked about healthcare policy several times on our show. Jonathan Oberlander, welcome back to Fresh Air. So let's see if we can understand what's happening with the McCain and Obama healthcare plans. Let's start with McCain, as your article starts with McCain. Now, you say his plan embraces market forces and promotes individually purchased insurance. So how does his plan promote market forces?
What John McCain wants to do is move away from the employer-sponsored insurance system. And that is the way that most working-age Americans get health insurance right now. About 160 million Americans get insurance through their employer. And the individual insurance market, where people go out on their own and buy insurance, is actually very small right now. What he wants to do is give people tax credits to buy private insurance, and they would buy that private insurance out on the individual market. And the hope is that that would unleash competition by insurers, and they would compete to offer lower prices on those insurance products.
What changes would the McCain plan make in how health insurance is taxed?
Actually, a fairly radical change. Right now, workers do not pay taxes on what their employers contribute to workers' health insurance. So when my employer here in North Carolina pays my insurance premium, that doesn't count as part of my taxable income. And that is a huge subsidy that the federal government gives to employer-sponsored health insurance. What the McCain plan would do for the first time is it would count employers' contributions to workers' health insurance premiums as taxable income. So if this plan was adopted, I would start paying taxes on what my employer pays for my health insurance.
And how would the McCain plan deal with tax credits?
What the McCain plan would do is take the money they get from eliminating the tax exclusion and put that money back into refundable tax credits. And so any American who obtained private health insurance, either through their employer or on their own, would get either $2,500 as an individual or $5,000 for a family. Now, if I'm an individual that does not have access to employer-sponsored insurance, I would take that credit and I would try and go out on the individual market and buy my own insurance. If I was a worker who currently has health insurance through my employer, I would have two options. I could use the tax credit to offset what I would now have to pay in taxes on my own health insurance benefits, or I could take the tax credit and leave my employer's health insurance plan and go out on the individual market and buy my own coverage.
I guess I don't see how the employee gets an advantage out of this. They're paying taxes that they hadn't paid before.
Well, I think politically this is a very hard sell, because when you think of middle-class Americans who are well-insured right now, and we should not forget, for all the problems in the system, many of those with employer-sponsored insurance like the coverage they have, like the benefits they have. When they hear the word health reform, what comes to their mind first is not, let's tax my health care benefits. So this idea of taxing employers' health insurance contributions has been around for a long time, and it hasn't gone anywhere. And one of the reasons it hasn't gone anywhere is politically it is very, very difficult for Congress to pass something that says, look, we've done something great for you in American health care. We're going to tax your health benefits. Now, what the McCain people say is they're going to take all the money they're going to get from taxing people's health benefits, and it's a lot. It's about $3.5 trillion over a decade, and they're going to turn around and convert that to a tax credit. And so any American who has private insurance would get this tax credit. And if you're a worker, you would use that tax credit to offset what you would pay in taxes. And in the short run, for most workers, that's probably true. The problem is that healthcare costs go up much more rapidly than the rest of the economy. So over time, the value of that credit, if it is indexed to the rest of the economy, is not going to keep up with the price of health insurance. And if we go out 10, 15 years from now, many more American workers will be paying taxes on their health insurance.
So it sounds like this might benefit people who don't have employee-based health insurance. But for the people who do have employee-based health insurance, is it possible that they'll be losing out in this program?
I think that's right. The McCain plan is a roll of the dice. We really don't know what the impact would be, but you can bet that some employers are going to drop health insurance coverage. So some Americans who are insured right now would lose their insurance coverage, and then they would have to go out to the individual market and try and find coverage. Now, for folks who don't have health insurance through work right now, they're not getting any benefit from that tax exclusion because their employer is not providing health insurance. So this would be a new benefit for them. Whether it's an adequate benefit is a different story.
If you have employer-based health insurance, what are the odds that the taxes you're going to have to pay on the amount of money that your employer kicks into your health insurance plan is going to be less than the amount that you're getting in tax credits through the McCain plan? What are the odds that you're going to come out on the winning end?
The McCain campaign has not released the detailed distributional effects of their plan, so it's very difficult to say. It really, the odds depend on where you live and who you work for. If you're at a company right now that has a very healthy workforce and you're in a low-cost area for health insurance, say Minnesota, then this is either going to be a wash or you could do a little better. If you're in a company that has an older workforce in an area that has very expensive health insurance costs, then in the short run, it could be for some people you're going to do worse. But I really think the important question is not what's going to happen a year after this plan is passed or 2 years after this plan is passed. The question is a decade after this is passed. And in that circumstance, I think a lot of people would come out on the losing end.
Because the costs of health care are likely to have gone up proportionately higher than the tax credits that you're getting.
That's right. And if you look at the tax credit amounts, what McCain is proposing is $2,500 for an individual and $5,000 for a family. And those credit amounts over time probably would be indexed to the general inflation rate. But healthcare rises much faster than the general inflation rate. So over time, they're going to be less and less sufficient to buy health insurance and to offset the cost of paying taxes on your health insurance.
Say you don't have employer-based health insurance and you want to buy insurance on the private market under the McCain plan, or you just decide you want private insurance instead of your employer-based plan, what options would you have under the McCain plan?
I think the McCain plan has two major problems. And the first is the adequacy of the tax credits. If you look at the average cost of health insurance right now on the employer-sponsored market, it's about $12,500 for family coverage and around $5,000 for individual coverage. So the credits that he's offering are really not sufficient to buy comprehensive health insurance. Most people, the only insurance they could afford is high deductible catastrophic insurance. Now, if you're young and healthy, you might be able to get a pretty good deal. The problem, and this is the second problem with the McCain plan, the problem with the individual market is that there is a lot of medical underwriting on the individual market, so that people who are sick, people who are older, people who are considered bad risks by insurance companies are charged substantially more in premiums, or in some states, they won't be offered coverage at all. So for a lot of Americans who have pre-existing conditions, even pre-existing conditions that may seem minor to them, they're going to have a real problem finding affordable, comprehensive coverage on that market. There's a second issue here, which is for young, healthy people who are insured right now by their employer, they actually might be able to get a better deal on the individual market. And under the McCain plan, they would have that choice. They could take the tax credit, leave their employer's insurance and go and buy individual insurance that's a better financial deal. Now, that might be good for them. The problem is, what effect does it have on the employer-sponsored market? If healthy people disproportionately leave employer-sponsored insurance, then the cost of insurance for people who are still getting their coverage from their employer is going to go up tremendously, and we're going to have an even faster erosion of employer-sponsored insurance.
Now, part of the McCain plan is based on the premise that with more competition in the private insurance market and more people buying private insurance, that competition will keep prices competitive, will keep prices down. Is there evidence that that it would accomplish that?
We don't know. The individual insurance market, of course, has some price competition right now because there are Americans who go out and buy insurance that way. And the question is, with this tax credit and by offering a more limited tax credit, how much would insurers hold down costs? My guess is that they're really not going to be able to hold down costs substantially more than they do now. And I doubt very much that individuals are going to be able to get a better deal out of insurers than employers do, because after all, employers have much more purchasing power. So what you would see instead is that insurers would offer high deductible products, and there would be shift in the United States away from comprehensive insurance and to these thinner insurance policies where the coverage isn't as comprehensive. And the McCain campaign believes that would happen, and they believe that's a good thing. There are a lot of health economists who think that one of the problems in the United States is actually that we have too much health insurance. And so one of the designs of the McCain plan is to shift towards high deductible coverage.
And that's supposed to discourage us from frivolous tests and other health care costs?
That's exactly right. The idea is that if you have, and this is a terrible phrase that we have in healthcare, but if you have skin in the game, then you'll think twice about overusing the healthcare system. The problem, of course, is you may discourage medical care that is appropriate and that is necessary. And we know from research that individuals are actually lousy judges of what is necessary and what is unnecessary.
Now, what if you are high risk and private insurers don't really want to cover you because you're sick?
The McCain campaign took a lot of criticism for that. Elizabeth Edwards in particular argued that she wouldn't be able to get coverage with breast cancer under McCain's plan, and that John McCain himself wouldn't be able to get coverage because of his skin cancer. Eventually, what the McCain campaign responded with is what they call a guaranteed access plan. Right now, there are about 34 states that have something that's called a high-risk pool, where they create a sort of subsidized insurance pool for folks who are medically uninsurable, who can't get coverage on the individual market. And so the state creates this pool where they can buy coverage. And what the McCain campaign has in mind, although the details are vague, is sort of a super high-risk pool where the federal government would work with the states. And in theory, it's a good idea. The problem with it is that high-risk pools have a very mixed record across the states. A lot of them are very expensive. A lot of them do exactly the same things that private insurers do. In other words, they have pre-existing condition exclusions. They have benefit limitations. And it's not clear at all that you would be able to create a high-risk pool that would be well-funded enough and comprehensive enough really to take care of those who are medically uninsurable. So if we're going to put more people on the individual insurance market, I think the reality is a lot of those people, especially if they're coming from the employer market, which has a lot of flaws, but it does provide broad pooling, those medically uninsurable folks, a lot of them just simply aren't going to find coverage.
Any other key points you think we should know about the McCain health insurance plan?
I think his proposal around deregulation of the insurance market is interesting. Insurance regulation is done primarily at the state level, and it varies by states. And there are some states that have very strict regulation of insurers. They require, for instance, community rating, so insurers have to charge everybody essentially the same price regardless of health status. They may have benefit mandates where they list benefits that insurance companies have to cover. And one of the conservative critiques of that has been that it drives up premiums and makes it hard for people to afford coverage. And so what the McCain plan has is a provision that would allow people to buy insurance across state lines, and insurers could now market their products nationwide. And what that means is that if I'm living in a state that has a highly regulated insurance market like New York, I could go out and buy insurance theoretically from a company that's offering coverage in a state that doesn't have those regulations, and so their policy is cheaper. Again, theoretically, that offers people another option. The problem with it is what it does is it effectively deregulates the insurance protections that we already have. And again, you risk healthy people dropping out of those insurance pools and going to these states that don't have strong benefit mandates, and that will leave sick people in states like New York in their insurance pools, and that will drive up costs, and that will drive a lot of people out of those insurance plans.
My guest is Jonathan Oberlander. His article comparing the Obama and McCain healthcare reform plans was published this month in the New England Journal of Medicine. He'll talk about the Obama plan after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Jonathan Oberlander. He's an associate professor of social policy and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and he's about to take a leave there to join the Russell Sage Foundation as a visiting scholar. Well, we've looked at the John McCain healthcare proposal. Let's look at Barack Obama's plan. You say that whereas McCain relies on market forces, Obama's plan relies on an employer mandate, new public and private insurance programs, and insurance market regulation. As far as employers, it's a pay-or-play system revolving around employers. Would you describe employers' role in healthcare insurance in the Obama plan?
Barack Obama would require that employers either have to offer comprehensive health insurance to their workers or they have to pay a tax to the government. And the government would use the money from that tax to cover the uninsured. Now, he has said that that employer mandate would not apply to very small businesses. The campaign has not said exactly where they would set the threshold for that exemption, but maybe for businesses under 10 workers, they would not be subject to the mandate. Other small businesses would get a tax credit to help them buy health insurance. But all businesses, except for those ones that are excluded, would have to either provide insurance or pay that tax.
Now, is that intended to have an effect of either encouraging or discouraging employers from providing health insurance to their employees?
The Obama campaign says they want to build on the employer-sponsored system. And really, the reason to do that is political and financial. A lot of people have employer-sponsored insurance, and they like it. It's difficult to move them away from that coverage. And employers right now spend over $400 billion on insurance premiums. So if you get rid of the employer-sponsored system, you've got to make up a lot of money. So in one sense, they want to reinforce the employer-sponsored system by having this modified employer mandate. But really, the effect of the Obama plan depends in part on where they set that tax. If they set the tax for not offering health insurance at a very high level, say 9%, then many employers will offer coverage themselves rather than paying the tax. But if they set the tax at a very low level, say 4 or 5%, then many employers will choose, because it's a better deal, to pay the tax rather than offering health insurance. And you would have people move out of the employer-sponsored system and perhaps into the new national health plan that Obama wants to create.
So for people who won't have employer-based health insurance, what options does the Obama plan have?
He has two new options. And right now, the campaign has said that these options would be open to anybody who is uninsured and to small businesses as well that want to enroll their employees in these options. And perhaps over time, they would be open to more Americans. The first option is a new national health plan, and this would be modeled after Medicare. It would be a new federal health plan for those under the age of 65, and so the federal government would set the premiums and set the benefits, and have ultimate administrative responsibility for the plan. The second option is they would create a new health insurance pool. They call it a national health insurance exchange. And what you would have in this exchange is multiple private insurance plans that would compete to enroll people. And they would be heavily regulated. They could not charge sicker people more in terms of premiums. They would have to have guaranteed issue. In other words, they would have to offer coverage to anybody no matter how sick they were. They couldn't dump you in the middle of the year, as sometimes happens right now to people in the individual market. So they would be highly regulated. If you were uninsured or if you worked for a small business and your small business chose to be part of this, you could choose. You could either join the new national health plan or you could join one of these private health insurance options.
Jonathan Oberlander will be back in the second half of the show. He's an associate professor of social policy and health policy management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and a scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jonathan Oberlander. We're comparing the Obama and McCain health care reform plans. Oberlander wrote about those plans in his article, The Partisan Divide, published in the New England Journal of Medicine this month. When we left off, Oberlander was explaining that under the Obama plan, the uninsured and small businesses who want to enroll employees would have the option of a national health plan modeled on Medicare or a new health insurance exchange with a choice of private insurance plans. What are the pros and cons of having a national government-sponsored health insurance plan as well as private plans?
I think the advantage of a national health plan is that it provides stability. We have had a lot of trouble with private health insurance in this country. It is an industry that is very flawed. It is an industry that in many ways has relied on medical underwriting and other practices that deprive people of the ability to access affordable health insurance coverage. The advantage of the government is we don't have to worry about the government doing medical underwriting. It doesn't in Medicare. It wouldn't in this. We don't have to worry about the government trying to make a profit off this. We don't have to worry about marketing expenses. So I think a public plan would offer a more stable option, perhaps a cheaper option if they can hold down costs and if their administrative costs are lower, as Medicare's are, compared to private insurance. The disadvantage is anytime you have choice in health insurance, there's a risk of what economists call adverse selection. And what adverse selection means is a disproportionate share of expensive, sicker people choose a particular health insurance plan. And when that happens, the costs go up and it becomes hard to maintain that plan. So if, in this example, you have small businesses that have very sick employees, very expensive employees, and those employees end up enrolled in the national health plan, then the national health plan could experience very high costs. And as we've learned from Medicare, I would say the second risk is it's not easy to regulate competition and to ensure fair competition between a public plan and a private plan. We have a lot of experience with that form of competition in Medicare. Unfortunately, it's not very good experience.
So Obama's plan is to finance his health care plan in part through these taxes that employers would have to pay if they choose to not provide health insurance to their employees. What are the other ways that Obama proposes to fund his health care plan?
He has two other sources. The first is he anticipates substantial savings from a number of measures, including moving to electronic medical records, doing a better job at disease management with chronic conditions, having a much better system of public health and prevention. The second way that he gets money to pay for his plan, and his plan is expensive, is to let the tax cuts of 2001 and 2003 that the Bush administration sponsored for Americans making over $250,000, let those tax cuts expire and redirect that money to pay for covering the uninsured. I think that probably the hardest part of health reform is how to pay for it. It's what I call the $100 billion question, because if you're adding the uninsured to the existing system, it's roughly $100 billion a year to do it. Both the Obama's financing solutions are problematic. In terms of the savings, those are all very desirable things to do. Electronic medical records are a good idea. Doing a better job with chronic conditions is a good idea. Trying to reduce our obesity levels and increasing prevention is a good idea. I don't think any of those are going to produce substantial sums of money in the short term. They might in the long term, but not in the short term. So I just don't think you can finance a health plan that way. In terms of the tax cuts, the Congressional Budget Office is really sort of the oracle at Delphi. They really, because of the congressional budget rules, get to say what counts as financing. And if you look at their projections, they already assume that all the tax cuts from 2001 and 2003, not just those for wealthy Americans, all the tax cuts will expire. So you actually don't get any new money at all as far as the Congressional Budget Office is concerned when you let those tax cuts expire and try to use them for health care. So the bottom line is that if Obama wins, his administration would have to come up with another way to get somewhere in between $60 and $100 billion. And that politically is very difficult.
There is a mandate in the Obama plan for health insurance for children. So all children would have health insurance. Would they have to pay for it, or would it just be a right that they would just automatically have it?
This was a big controversy in the primary because Hillary Clinton had a mandate for all Americans and Barack Obama has one only for children. And what the Obama people have argued is that most of the uninsured are uninsured because they can't afford coverage. And so once we create affordable options, we won't need to mandate them. And furthermore, that it's putting the cart before the horse. If we have a mandate before we ensure that those affordable options are out there, we'll just be punishing people. And they think they can get to 98, 99% coverage without a mandate. I think that, again, is a high number. I think the Obama plan would cover most of the uninsured, but it certainly would not reach universal coverage without a mandate. In terms of how the mandate would work for children, we really don't know at this point. And a mandate is an interesting concept in that it has bipartisan appeal. Liberals like it if it's going to move towards universal coverage. Conservatives like the individual responsibility associated with it. The problem politically is it's only as good as the penalty. And if you don't have a robust penalty, a mandate isn't worth much. And for good reason, most politicians running for president don't want to talk about penalties. So they haven't actually detailed how they would enforce this mandate. And again, if he's elected, there would be a battle over any kind of mandate, whether it's for children or adults, about how exactly you're going to enforce it. The Kaiser Family Foundation did a poll and they asked people what they thought of having financial penalties for not having health insurance. And I think around 80% of Americans said they didn't like the idea very much. So politically, this is dangerous territory.
So in the Obama plan, for people who are buying insurance on the private market or for people who would be going to the government plan, any estimate of how much it would cost?
No. The Obama plan itself has released an estimate of how much they think they would save Americans. But I would say that estimate is quite uncertain, and it's based on those savings that I think in the short term are exaggerated. We do know that they would make coverage more accessible to Americans who cannot get coverage right now because they're sick. And the reason for that is they're going to regulate private health insurance and they're going to move to a system where you can't charge sick people more. We also know that the Obama plan is going to provide subsidies for people with low and moderate incomes to buy health insurance. And so they would have assistance from the government. But again, we don't know what the level of that subsidy is. The final thing that they're going to do, which I think is important in terms of the affordability of private health insurance, is they have a provision for what's called reinsurance. And the idea is that in any given health insurance pool, a few people are very expensive. So about 5% of Americans account for almost half of all healthcare costs in this country. So about 15 million people cost about $1 trillion. And particularly for small employers, if they have an employee who, God forbid, has cancer or has HIV, AIDS, and they're very expensive, it really hurts their ability to offer insurance coverage because they don't have a big pool. What the Obama plan would do is have the government come in as a reinsurer. Above a catastrophic level, the government would actually pay the cost for very expensive workers. And theoretically, that would enable employers to lower their insurance insurance premiums, I think the Obama campaign has estimated, by 5%, because they're no longer covering the costs of those catastrophic cases. The federal government is.
Now, you say in your article in the New England Journal of Medicine that the health care plans that Barack Obama and John McCain have proposed offer opposing visions of health care reform that reflect fundamentally different assumptions about the virtues and vices of markets and governments. Can you elaborate on that?
There is really a philosophical divide here, and there are many issues on which John McCain and Barack Obama disagree. I'm not sure there's any issue on which they disagree more than healthcare. And their diagnosis of the problem and their solutions are entirely different. And I think that stems in part from very different philosophical assumptions. John McCain's assumptions are that he has faith in the market, that what we should be doing in the healthcare system is really trying to enhance competition, that healthcare at some level is an individual responsibility, and we should give individuals the chance to make choices in healthcare, and it's really up to them to buy health insurance. Barack Obama starts with, instead of individual responsibility, collective responsibility, that healthcare coverage is a collective issue, that we're all in this together, and he has faith in the government and believes that we can't leave the market unfettered in healthcare, that the government has to step in with a new plan, with regulation. And so that the reason you get this huge divide between their plans is they just have an ideological clash on healthcare reform. And that's part of why this is such a difficult issue to settle, because both these candidates represent really where the Democratic and Republican parties are right now on this issue.
Now that you've done such a good job explaining the Obama and McCain healthcare plans, let me ask you this. If either is elected president, what are the odds that their respective health care plan would actually pass Congress?
I guess I would say I'm a cautious pessimist about health care reform. You know, my base is always to bet against health care reform because, after all, we've had a century of failure. So I think for either of these plans, the odds, frankly, are not good. If you take the McCain plan, although in some ways it's less ambitious than the Obama plan because it doesn't cover most of the uninsured, in other ways it's more radical because it wants to move away from the employer-sponsored insurance system. That is not going to be popular with a lot of workers. It's actually not popular, surprisingly enough, with a lot of employers who are paying for health insurance. And I think the politics of trying to get rid of the tax exclusion and tax healthcare benefits is just awful. So I think he would have a very difficult time getting that plan through. If you take Obama's plan, if you look at what he wants to do, he wants to adopt an employer mandate. He wants to enact a new national health plan. He wants to regulate the American insurance industry in a way they've never been regulated. If he could do any one of those three things as president, that would be tremendous. If he can do all three of them, he probably deserves his face on a stamp in the future. It's a very high hill to climb. At the same time, the chances really depend on the election. If Barack Obama wins and if Democrats pick up seats in the Senate, and remember, they really need 60 or close to 60 seats in the Senate to beat back a filibuster, then I do think he has a chance. I would not bet on it, but I do think there is a chance this could happen. If John McCain wins and Republicans get a majority in Congress, then again, he has a chance. So it really depends. We'll know a lot more after the first week of November.
Well, Jonathan Overlander, thanks so much for explaining those plans to us. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Jonathan Overlander is an associate professor of social policy and health policy management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and he's a scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation. In the new movie comedy, Hamlet 2, Steve Coogan stars as a failed actor turned high school drama teacher whose theater program is threatened by budget cuts. To prove that high school theater is essential, he unleashes his pent-up creativity and writes a play he's confident will demonstrate the transformative power of theater. Here's a scene in which he hands a copy of his finished play to his wife, played by Catherine Keener.
It's done.
What is?
My original work that's going to say drama, the thing I've been working on for the last 47 billion hours.
Oh, is that what you were doing? I thought you were just having a nervous meltdown.
You're not far off, Lady Pence.
any creative person will tell you, you got to go a little crazy to make great art.
Hamlet 2?
The Deuce, correct.
Doesn't everybody die at the end of the first one?
I have a device.
The time machine door.
That's the device.
Opens, revealing Hamlet, Gertrude, Polonius, and Hillary Clinton having what appears to be group sex.
It's about my troubled relationship with my father.
But you're doing this at school with the kids, right?
That's the plan, Stan. What do you think?
A scene from Hamlet 2. My guests Pam Brady and Andrew Fleming wrote the film. Fleming also directed it. Pam Brady co-wrote many episodes of South Park, as well as the South Park movie musical and Team America. Fleming directed Dick, The Craft, and Nancy Drew. Before we talk, let's hear the big production number of the teacher's musical Hamlet 2. This is Rock Me Sexy Jesus.
He's totally the man with the plan. He traveled through time in an awesome custom van. Moralistically, he taught us to be good, how to set our souls free and do all the shit we should. Now we do the right deeds, we go to church and such, and we stop smoking weed, well, at least not as much. And we can't forget to mention the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have them. Slam, bam, spank you, ma'am.
Do unto you.
Rock me, sexy Jesus. He died for our sins. You gotta believe us. Rock me, sexy Jesus.
Pam Brady, Andrew Fleming, welcome to Fresh Air. Just describe the premise of the musical Hamlet 2 from which Rock Me Sexy Jesus comes from.
It's conceived by an ex-failed actor who teaches drama in Tucson, Arizona, and it's his last attempt at greatness, and he's decided to write a musical sequel to Hamlet, and Hamlet uses a time machine to travel back in time to save his mother and the king and Polonius and everybody who dies at the end of Hamlet. But because he's not very good at operating the time machine, he ends up in modern day Tucson with Jesus Christ as his time traveling companion.
What do you love or what do you hate about musicals?
Well, the thing that I used to hate about musicals is that arbitrary moment where people just start singing. It always bothered me. Like, why do they start singing? And now I actually think that's the great thing of them, because it's sort of the id coming to life. It's people expressing what they can't express just by speaking. And I'd never done musical numbers before this movie, and I was slightly terrified, but it ended up being the most exhilarating, fun thing I've ever done in a movie. It really was a blast, I have to say.
And Pam, what about you? What do you love or hate about musicals?
Well, you know what? The thing I think the thing I love and hate about musicals is the same thing, which is the earnestness. And sometimes it's too earnest, so that it just sort of pushes you away, so you can't really connect with it. But then sometimes if you're earnest, like in this form, we try to be earnest in the musical and in this movie, but you can kind of undercut it.
Now, your movie Hamlet 2 is set in Tucson, and once the drama teacher decides to like write and stage his creative masterpiece musical, he enlists the Tucson Gay Men's Chorus to sing, and you give them the really incongruous song to sing of "Maniac" from Flashdance. let's play a little of it, and then we'll talk about it.
Just a steel town girl on a Saturday night, looking for the fight of her life. In the real-time world, no one sees her at all. They all say she's crazy. Locking rhythms to the beat of her heart, changing moment into light.
she has danced into the danger zone when the dancer becomes the dance. It can cut you like a knife if the gift becomes a fire on the wire between will and what will be. She's a maniac, maniac on the floor. And she's dancing like she's never danced before. She's a maniac, maniac on the floor. And she's dancing like she's never danced before.
That's a version of Maniac from the new film Hamlet 2. The co-writers of the film, Pam Brady and Andrew Fleming, are my guests. Fleming also directed the film. So why did you want them to sing this song? Why, of all the songs that you could have given them, why this one?
It's a good song. The lyrics are really strange, but it's an enthusiastic song, and that was kind of the idea, that it was about, a tough girl from the wrong side of the tracks making good. And I don't know, who doesn't love the Flashdance soundtrack?
Especially when he plays it sadly, you know, after his wife leaves him, and he plays a sad version of Maniac on his personal Casio, and that always kind of reminded us of the Entertainment Tonight theme. When they do Entertainment Tonight after someone, they do, you know, someone died. It's slower. It's like Entertainment Tonight, someone died. So that was an inspiration.
Were you in high school or college when Flashdance came out, and was it a big deal?
I was in college studying film, and I saw it and was horrified. But now I love it.
My guests are Pam Brady and Andrew Fleming. They co-wrote the new film Hamlet 2. Fleming also directed it. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests Pam Brady and Andrew Fleming wrote the new movie comedy Hamlet 2. Fleming also directed it. Now, your film Hamlet 2 is in part a satire of inspirational teacher movies, where a teacher in an inner city school filled with gang members kind of inspires them to turn their lives around. And why did you want to satirize that kind of inspirational movie?
Well, I just think over time, that form has become very cynical. And we didn't want to do something that we are not very cynical. And I think that the movie sort of has sort of a sweetness to it. Because especially with Dangerous Minds, the idea that Michelle Pfeiffer is a Marine and she's going to jack a young gangbanger up against a locker so he can get his head on straight. I just think it's such a condescending idea.
And we didn't really want to satirize those movies. We wanted to kind of make one of those movies, but one where the teacher thinks he's living one of those movies, that he is inspirational, but in truth he's just kind of an idiot.
Oh, yeah, and he says all these pontificating things about how the theater has the power to transform the actor and the audience. And, of course, it does have that power, but his theater does not.
Yeah, we always like this guy because he has the form down. He has the manner down, but he just has no content.
But I think in the end that his play actually does transform everybody involved, that it's a really pretentious thing for him to say up front. But then he, in fact, achieves that goal.
When you were writing Hamlet 2, did you make a point of going to musicals or renting musicals for inspiration? And if so, what did you see?
Actually, the first drafts of the script, the play was just kind of a series of images, and you never really saw the play. You saw people's reactions to it. And it had music, but it didn't have musical numbers. And it wasn't until just a few months before we started shooting that we decided to turn it into a full-on musical, much to the producer's horror and chagrin. But I think we both felt that if we didn't see more of the play, it was going to be a cheat. So we made more of it than was there on the page.
But also one of the big inspirations, too, is that we went to see the Madonna live tour. And I forget what tour it was. It was the tour, but she was on a cowboy saddle, but also a stripper pole. And it was just spectacle. And she had images behind her on this giant screen that was like Condoleezza Rice. Hitler, Darfur.
Yeah.
And it just thought it was so wonderfully irresponsible just to not to throw those images out and not put it into context.
And she crucified herself on a cross made out of video screens.
Did she really?
We just loved the irresponsibility of it.
So you took inspiration from that?
Oh, in a big way.
She is an inspiration.
Steve Coogan is very funny in Hamlet, too, and he's good at the verbal humor and the physical comedy. Can either of you point to a scene where he so surprised you with his choices and the way he brought your writing to life?
There's one scene where he does this monologue. He's found out that the drama department has been shut down, and he kind of goes on a rant in front of the class about his childhood and his failed career as an actor and about just his general frustration. And it's really funny, but he's also weeping uncontrollably through it. So it's sad. And I just remember when we were shooting that, I was just thinking, that's amazing. I've never seen something like that before. And he did it over and over and over. He really is amazing.
Well, Pam Brady, Andrew Fleming, thanks so much to both of you for talking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Pam Brady and Andrew Fleming wrote the movie Hamlet 2. Fleming also directed it. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui-Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.